that too. As soon as I click this button.
And click that?
I did.
Because you know what? Part of the fun of this show for me is getting to fake my way through it. And when I say that, I mean that in the most respectful, loving way possible. Because that's all I feel like I'm ever doing in my life. And if I've done anything well, I was faking it at the time. And it just worked out. I was just a lucky bum. That's why nothing works out for me.
You're a sad sack lucky bum.
Sad sack lucky bum. No. No, I mean, you know, the faking it thing, I think, is a good place to start. Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com.
And, yeah, okay, faking it, why not? Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com.
It's the faking it that I'm interested in at the start. No, you know, it was a line in a TV show I once saw. And yeah, as we all know, that's where all wisdom lies, is that one of the characters who, oh gosh, what was this in? I think this was in Dead Like Me, that series that was on television, 10 years ago or something like that, where Mandy Patinkin's character, who was like this kind of surly boss character, always in control, always managing all these problems, and he has this kind of a little bit of a crisis in the second season. And the lead character goes to him. She's always going to him for guidance. She asks him a question. What should I do? What's the right thing, the wrong thing to do in the situation? He turns to me. He's like, look, I don't know. I'm just faking it like everybody else. And it's this moment where, like, her big hero starts to crumble in front of her. You know, the moment when you find out dad's not the smartest guy in the world. It's that moment for the character. But that line stuck with me because it's like, yeah, you know, you go through that time in your youth where you look up and adults are so, they just have all the answers to everything. And then you get a little bit older and you realize, oh my God, he didn't know. And he's faking it. And what are you going to do? You get to crack up. You get to say, oh my gosh, there's no point in going on. Because after all, the world is being, it's a big ship of fools and we're all blind and we can't figure our way through this thing. We're going to blow ourselves up eventually. Or are you going to take heart in that and say, well, we've gotten this far on faking it. Maybe I could get a little bit farther, you know? the Apollo program was a bunch of guys faking it, figuring it out as they went along. That's what I mean by faking it. I don't mean faking it as in pretending to be something you're not, but faking it as improvising, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of people would look at someone jumping into a task that they haven't completely preconceived what is going to happen, what will be their precise response and then it just sort of plays out like some kind of clockwork or Rube Goldberg machine where, or executing some instructions like a player piano or some code where I'm like, I do this, then I do that, bing, bing, bing. And then, the funny thing is like you could have studied that thing, but then the situation you're facing now isn't exactly like what you studied. And then you just go ahead anyway.
Yeah. And it's not to say like, oh, just believe in yourself. You can hang glide, go out tomorrow, put some trash bags on a coat hanger.
Flap your arms really hard.
Yeah. No, it is recognizing a connection between what you have learned and what skills you do have and what the situation requires. For instance, we were talking, I can't remember if we talked about this in the show or not. I apologize, Rob. I'm tired. It's been, we both had very, very intense weeks. But I at least talked about this with you off mic, if not on mic. But I recently went to a student event where it was ostensibly to honor the students' achievements in the classes that they were all taking. So my class, the graphic novel class, did a display of their work, and then I'm there all dressed up to talk with parents about what the kids did. But what it quickly turns into is me justifying the class to the parents. Like, this is why it's okay that they take a comics class. Not all parents. A lot of the parents are awesome, but there's always that one who's like, yeah, good thing they took this class and that they'll never do anything with, you know? Good thing that you taught them how to make a funny strip that will ultimately not give them any usable skills in the real world. And it turns into me very patiently, or trying to be patient, explaining to them, well, but no, this is where all these skills can be applied. And even if they wanted to go into comics, they could still make money if they do X, Y, and Z. There's a bunch of different ways to make money at this stuff, but requires them to be creative, et cetera. And I was telling this to you, and you came up with five or six different examples of not even careers, but like clear thinking, logical thinking, right? Visual literacy, being able to communicate with teams.
Oh, sure. And being able to back up your points in a situation, like perhaps some ideas get brought up in a group situation, perhaps at a profession where you're actually making money. And I would call that a professional situation where someone who had been used to all the intentional and emotional communication that goes into making a comic, that they're able to dial in and communicate and work with whatever is at hand at that moment in order to assist the group in communicating, right? And they're going to be looked at as some kind of capable, helpful person for whatever their role is.
In other words, taking a comics class could potentially assist you as a banker, as a marketing person, as a postal carrier, right? The skills that they learn, that's the thing. The stuff that they're learning in the class is ephemeral. It's in the air. It's something that was spoken or a moment that happened in interaction between students. That's not the thing that's getting captured on paper. Anyway, my point is that my job at that point at the assembly celebration thing is to explain to the parents the overlap of skill sets, make them aware of that, and not just and try to divert the conversation away from, well, where's the money? Where's the money? How is my kid going to survive? I totally get that's why they're concerned. But let's talk about enriching your child too. Let's talk about not just money, but also making your child like a whole human being to put into the real world. But going back to our original point, there's one of my many, many anecdotes that lead us off into nowhere land. You know, it's like having a faith that, okay, maybe I don't have 100% of the skills or the knowledge, or I don't think I do to handle the situation. Maybe I can. This seems like something we've beaten. This is a drum we've beaten on a lot. And, you know, always with the caveat of, you know, we're not talking about brain surgery, not talking about open heart surgery. We're not talking about CPR. We're not talking.
Yeah, exactly.
We're not talking about building
the absolutist. And you can be an absolutist and come in and poop on anyone's conversation if you really want to. It's easy. And you know, that's cool if it's your hobby, but like there's another, there's other, other things to get out of what we're saying. It's a, there's soft skills. There's skills that help glue other things together to help, people work together, what have you. And, that willingness to sort of jump in, there's a, what is this? Gosh, it's, something in what is it, chaotic systems, and I am way weak in math and in a lot of things actually. But it was a cool concept that I came across called a strange attractor, that there was a statistical significance between some subset of a chaotic system. So imagine like a bunch of beads floating in the air, like maybe they're floating in water that's all whooshing around, and or you know, like ping pong balls in a lottery thing.
The tumbler.
And what if you could watch that in slow motion enough where you saw some flow to it, right? And I'm making this as a visual analogy for the chaotic system, right?
Okay.
And there was a, and it's probably a bad analogy in a bunch of ways, but just thinking about an object moving away from the group where all of a sudden it causes other objects to group around it.
Okay.
And then another object. And so those things that cause those crystallizations or those catalyst sections in the overall system are called strange attractors.
Okay.
I bet someone could really lecture me on how much I got wrong with that. But anyway, strange attractors, neat concept. And I think that idea does come into play when you are willing to just sort of jump in and start working with whatever is at hand to start discovering where the heck the limits are, and whether it's with the people in the room and their ideas, or whether it's with some resources that you have or don't have, such as time to accomplish something, and people are maybe using their imaginations too intensely and coming up with wild, extreme ideas that aren't going to help the group, you know, finish a cool sign for the cafeteria when they're like imagining using materials that you couldn't get or afford in time for 2 hours from now. But, and then someone can just say, oh, okay, jump in and like, well, I think we should start writing on the sign or whatever, or, you know, just start moving crap forward.
Pick a spot and start doing something. Yes. That's where I get a little impatient when I'm working with a group, is when people are going, well, we need more deliberation on this. We should have another meeting about this. We should really discuss what's the proper place to start. No, let's just start something and see what begins to move when we start the thing. Shall we? How about that? Oh God, you know, it's like I'm trying to find the segue into from this to the topic, and I feel like there's something there, but I'm just not seeing it. I can hear something crackling in the distance.
I can say our topic is I think it's related to this because I'd say recently both of us have found us in situations with professional projects and personal projects and all that stuff sort of colliding and needing to just adapt on the fly and reprioritize and all that kind of stuff. And that's a lot like, you're working on your own in that situation, but you're definitely playing that instigating role of like, well, here's a new situation. Now what? And
you ever get scared when you're doing that?
Oh yeah, totally. I think like when I debate as far as how to set aside a project or how to reflow some things I was working on, and if they really make me feel good, and they're part of how I see myself and the value I bring to the world, yeah, it scares the heck out of me. Yeah. Because I'm like, well, I'm part of me is dying.
Yeah.
Now what?
Yeah. And that clock is always ticking. I mean, that's what I was thinking about this last month when I was working on this book deadline was, I'm gonna get all sincere for a second. I had to set aside working on the front again, and I felt like again, I have to do this again. Well, this job is paying me money and it needs to be done in X amount of time. And looking at the calendar, looking at my time, my schedule, of work, the only way I'm going to get it done is if I cut several things off. You know, these appointments are getting canceled. This is going to get postponed until I'm done with that, you know, et cetera. And I felt like, you know, there was a couple moments where I was feeling a little bit of that irrational panic attack of, geez, I'm just going to keep on deferring this thing and deferring this thing and deferring this thing. And I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be 80 and I'm not going to have it done. And I'm going to say, where did all the time go? You know, I don't want that to happen to me. You know, it's that panic doesn't go away. Yeah, I guess it gets easier to control, but it doesn't go away, does it?
Oh, no. Yeah, I agree with that. Becoming familiar with it and I'm going to whip out a weird analogy again, too. So I would imagine if you had to herd some kind of powerful, wild beast of an animal, it's dangerous every time you do it. Even if you're really good at it.
Yeah, yeah. Even if you're like the lion tamer or the guy who's worked with bears his whole life, there's always that X factor in there, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure you're good at it, but it still has that some stress about it. And I don't know.
Well, I caught myself at its worst when the deadline and this whole stress of the workload was at its worst. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of stuff I don't really show people. I mean, nobody gets to see this happening with me. Is like I felt like this kind of like going back to one of the anecdotes I was talking about earlier is like having that father figure or that adult figure that you look up to. You can say, "What do I do?" And they can help you. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one of those moments where you know I was feeling like I need somebody to ask for help. I need to ask for help from somebody, and there's nobody to ask for help. And so I sat there and I just looked at myself and I was like, "Well, you know, this is your cross, buddy." And it didn't take the panic away. But it made me go, damn, this sucks. I got to deal with this. I got to figure this out on my own. And I've got to, you know, just as dumb as it sounds, do my best.
So did you end up getting to, I don't know, some kind of, where that ended up being like some kind of agreement that did help set aside your I don't know, huge concerns for, I don't know, somehow put them on pause or delay them or get into a different rhythm. I don't know.
No, I just push the feelings down further and further. No, yeah. Well, that is part of it. But no, one of the things, and we did talk about this off mic, I know that, is I said enough is enough. That's all I can stand. I can't stand no more. I said, I got to get interns back in here. You know, I have a bunch of young people who have helped me out in the past, but one of the problems I have, what a problem to have. You have young people who want to help you out in the studio, right, for free. Oh, boo-hoogers. Well, but the problem is that I really suck at delegating. I really suck at it, and I don't want to hand something to somebody who's not going to do it right. And it's not that these kids are dumb, and it's not that I don't trust them. It's that it's that weird kind of possessive, obsessive compulsive kind of thing where it's like, yeah, but I need to see it done in order to make sure it's done right, even though this is a simple thing that I know a kid could do, right? So like cleaning up my flats, cleaning up my line work, I know they can do that. And it was also a situation where it's like, well, then I got to be in the studio X month. I got to, you know, commit to this scheduled time. So that's when the kid's going to be over. Whereas right now I can move my schedule around as I please. So if I want to go grocery shopping at 2 p.m., I can just go do it and not have to answer to anybody, you know? So there's a little bit, there's a flexibility I'd be giving up then. But I sat down and I just said to myself, I announced it to Anne because I knew that if I said it to Anne, she's going to hold me to it, right? She's not going to let me get away with reneging on the whole deal. And I said, look, I'm just going to talk to these students of mine who have interned for me before, and I'm going to get them in the studio, and I need their help. I can't do this all by myself. So that was one. But the other one was something that David Say says. David Say of the Emergent Task Planner, which we talked about before, is... Mm-hmm. You know, the way stuff gets done is you chip at it. You just chip at it. And if you keep on, you got to pick your head up and look at the big picture. But if you don't keep your head down and chip at it too, nothing's ever to get done. And all the panicking and promising in the world won't fix it if you don't sit down and chip at it. And so I use that as my mantra throughout the whole thing. So like when I had 7 pages ahead of me to finish for this book and I'm putting in, you know, a full day's work on it and more, trying to make this deadline, and I see the calendars like moving faster than my workflow. The mantra became chip at it. You know, don't let yourself panic about this thing. Chip at it, and it will get done. You know,
it. Well, here's something that I wrestled with before with the whole chipping at it thing. I'm a big fan of the idea that, oh, I probably came across it in the Tao Te Ching, but the idea that essentially a stream can carve a mountain,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I even, let's see. So I on this Tumblr blog that I never update, last updated it during 24-hour comic day last year, but my little title or my blurb on the site that's sort of meant to summarize the purpose is, does a stream carving a mountain think it has unrealistic goals?
That's a very Taoist way to look at that Taoist expression. Yes. Yeah.
So, but the trick is, so let's say, you know, you get good at that. So you get good at chipping away at things and queuing things up and setting them aside, putting them on pause. But then here's a situation that I've run into lately is that, and not just, well, you know what? I'm always learning on this stuff and always coming up with new approaches and finding out things that I didn't manage well or whatever. But that idea, I'm fairly practiced at it as far as being able to chip away and iterate on a project over a long period of time. And well, I've found that sometimes I will add more projects and keep chipping at them, but then it diffuses me where, so a stream carving one mountain is enough of a challenge, but the same stream now dividing up to carve multiple mountains.
You add tributaries to that stream and you're taking all that water away from that initial stream. And it's going to be a much slower process cutting through that mountain, right?
Yep. It's the classic problem of the multi-classed Dungeons & Dragons character. And it always ticked me off. I should have known as a kid that I hit on a psychological thing that I just it made me so mad that experience points, I had to divide them up, right? As if I had multiple personalities or something among these different pursuits, right?
Well,
these
classes. So what multiple classes did you have?
Let's see. I had a ninja monk.
Okay.
Yep. It's gonna be his name was Robert Ming.
Oh, let's go there just for a second. This will be fun. Okay, you had Robert Ming, the ninja monk. What were some of the other ones you had?
I had a what was he? A ranger fighter called Sir Eugene.
Okay.
Sir Eugene the Jeep. Eugene is my middle name, but
so you named all your characters after yourself?
Yeah, I did.
That's awesome.
Yep. Those were my two main ones. I invested many years in both of them.
See, I didn't do multi-class. Interesting. I wonder what that says about us. I just dove headlong into each character class as if like, okay, let's see what I can get out of this. Where I ran into trouble was is that I always wanted to find a new twist to that class. So, okay, my thief was Kamado the president, and he would always introduce himself as, how you doing? I'm the president. Because he was the president of his country, but he decided that legislation and, dealing with municipal problems was way too boring, so he decided to become a thief, but he liked the prestige of being a president, so he still, threw around his authority that way. And the hardcore GMs who really stuck to their monstrous compendiums always gave me grief about my characters because there's no such thing as a thief who travels the world who's also the president of a small country. Why not? My other big one was Click. I don't know why his name was Click, but he was a you roll your initial stats, right? If I remember right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do random rolls to see what your initial
three dice six plus something depending on the at least back in the day.
So, yeah, and I remember rolling, like, really high, like 19 or 20 or something for strength. So, like, I got, like, a bonus for strength. So, like, this guy's going to be really strong. I'm like, nice. I'll be a warrior, and so he'll be axe-carrying warrior. But this guy's omniphobic. He's afraid of everything. So he's got all the strength, all the power. He's got all the weapons. But you really got to push this guy into a fight because, I took the lowest stat and put it on whatever courage was, whatever that stat was. You just don't do that. I got in trouble with the GM again. And I think that might have been part of it, as I liked pushing that guy's buttons. But also it was like I had fun with where can I find the surprise with this guy? Where can I find something that hasn't been done or I haven't seen yet at any rate? It did make it hard to play a guy who always failed his courage rolls or initiative rolls because he had like a minus to initiative or some crap like that. I don't remember all the rules of D&D.
Sure. No, that it's interesting. Obviously, you seem to obviously you were into baking in this inherent drama, where I was obviously into living some power fantasy.
I still have my Kamado the President gaming sheet. It's in my wallet. I keep it with me. I think it's the same piece of paper I wrote it on in like 1990. I'll show it to you when you come out for Kids Read Comics.
Awesome. Yeah.
Anyway,
so let's see. Yeah, I guess so. You didn't get to experience that sort of that lesson that I should have learned from, but the diffusion of your efforts across various things.
I learned how annoying I am to people. That's what I learned.
You learned how to push the buttons. It's good. It's funny. Later on, I gained a lot more appreciation for the storytelling aspects of those games, and the whole number systems got a little tiring.
Yeah,
but wasn't until trying out games from what was that company? They did the vampire stuff in the World of Darkness. Yeah,
not Palladium.
Oh, oops. Nope. They're escaping me, but they actually really emphasized the role playing. I mean, so that was how you got more points and you were able to build and grow your character a little more rapidly than by just doing stuff in the game. Was
kill the kobold and collect the gold, and now you get experience points. Yeah,
yeah, everything. D&D was very much a kind of a obviously precursor to modern gaming, where everything's a walking pinata of goodies.
We're going to be paying the price for that as a society in the next 20 years.
Gary Gygax.
I kid. No, I'm not that guy. I think video games are swell.
Yeah, obviously I do. Because, you know, one of the projects that I've kept around is that class I've been working on.
Yeah.
And it's been part of the puzzle where it's been satisfying to essentially. So I'm going to go ahead and put a little title to the conversation. So we've been trying to build up to this topic of or question of is doing less better than trying to do too much?
Can I answer that like right up front and then we can move on to actually discussing it? Is that sometimes yes, sometimes no. You know, it totally depends on the situation. And I think that question itself is misleading in the sense that what you're really talking about is adapting to situations, right? Adapting totally. To the situation and dealing with things as they change because in my opinion, you can't protect yourself from the future. You just deal with the future when it gets here. That's not to say you can't plan, but unexpected things happen. Things line up. The life is Lennon, right? John Lennon. Life's what happens when you're making other plans or something like that.
Sure.
You know, that sounds like it's like Pat kind of, you know, fortune cookie style advice, but
sure. Well, Art of War, no plan survives contact with the enemy kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
You're how you've conceived whatever you're working on is going to be different than the reality of what the forces of it and everything around you while you're actually doing it.
I think the more interesting part is the adaptation part for me.
Yep.
I think it's dealing with the unexpected. And in our particular cases, what we're talking about is figuring out how to get more out of less. But I don't want anybody to ever think that I'm going to say like, oh, you should always do less and never do more. There are times when you can do more. And when that time comes, if you're ready for it, yeah, do more. I'm doing more now day to day than I was 8 years ago, you know, when I was first getting into webcomics. 8 years ago, I was doing a page of a comic a week, which was Monday I would do the pencils, Tuesday I would do the inks, Wednesday I would do the halftones, Thursday I'd do a little blogging about it. And that was it. That was my whole contact with the web, you know, and answering the occasional email, you know. So like my day-to-day is like so much more now, you know. Should I go back to what I was doing in 2008 because it was so much better? No, I was miserable because I was hungry and I wanted more contact with everything, you know. So when the opportunities come up, you should take them. But it's managing and adapting to that. That's the hard part. And then maximizing the amount of effort that you get out of all of those day-to-day contacts, right?
Sure. Well, let's see. Everyone's relationship with what is more and whatnot is it's a different thing.
Let's talk about how you wanted to kick my butt before we started recording.
Yeah, sure. No problem. I will happily compliment you on Mike.
No, that's not what I was going for though. Although I'll take it.
Compliment fisherman. No, I totally. I'm being impish. So, we're talking about what we've been working on and getting caught up and whatnot before we get into the podcast. And I was curious because I've been a bit out of touch on the social networks, and I was assuming that if I had been more in touch, I'd know the status. So I was pre-apologizing, but asking Jersey, hey, what's up? Have you finished that big comic project yet? And, how's it going? And of course, Jersey has finished it, which is awesome. And how did it come up with, but I was curious how did it come up with how long did each page take you?
I have no idea. I don't remember what led into that.
It was very natural. It popped up in the conversation. I mean, I think it had to do with you getting up and dancing and then saying, I want to know something. there's something I know that you don't know.
There's something you don't know.
Exactly.
I was referring to how I was tracking my time with the Emergent Task Planner, and I went back to some of the days when I was working all day on it, and I tracked it out to where it was like, it was about 5 hours a page all told, and I said it with like a little bit of a sense of shame of like, it took 5 hours on some of those pages. I really noodled it.
I feel like throwing my desk by the every time you say it. I think it's awesome. Obviously, 5 hours a page. I am a lot slower than it. I mean, if I do a full color page, lettered, et cetera, it's probably I don't know, let's say approximately six panels with humanoid characters and all that, some background color, if I said that, shaded, it'll take me like 18 hours, 18 to 20 hours, depending.
Ryan Estrada the other day posted on Twitter that he flatted like 120 pages in a half hour.
What?
Because I'm fudging the number here, but it was in the hundreds, and it's because he's got Photoshop Actions set up to like automate so much of it for him, and he's got a system that works so well for him that he literally did over 100 pages in a half hour flatting. And you know, I mean, all this stuff is relative, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's, there's always, and my word though, seriously.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
On one hand, obviously, I feel a ping of I guess it's my own sense of you know, wanting to get better and feeling inadequate or whatever. But all of a sudden, you know, hearing that where it's like, holy crap, is that person better than me? Then you just went and upped it again.
Well, but see, that's where I wanted to go here, because one of the interesting things about adaptation to these situations is, who are you adapting for? Right? Who are you trying to improve for? Who, like, when I said that 5 hours thing, I know that part of me was saying, yeah, 5 hours. I know five guys who are way faster than that and better at it than I am. You know, I need to up my game to match them. I don't want to sound like a dad, but I know intellectually that that's the wrong way to go about it. I should be going 5 hours. I can do better than that for myself, right? The whole thing of competing with yourself, that old CBS after school special thing that everybody groans about. But it's like,
You can do both, though. I don't think just because you have an external example, I think it depends on how you use the external example.
Well, explain.
Like, you know, really following my chain of logic by saying, oh, you know, I'm reacting out of some kind of jealousy because of, you said 5 hours or whatever. Yeah, I'm being silly. It's impressive. I am truly, like, totally seriously really impressed, because those pages are really awesome looking, and that is pretty amazing to achieve that in like 5 to 6 hours. And at the same time, so now you've provided an example. I've become aware of a new threshold. How I choose to apply that threshold to me is an entirely different manner. So I can be like, oh, wish, want, grump, groan about it. Or I can just say, you know, well, where could I move that bar now for me? I'm not going to go from 18 to 20 down to 5, you know, but like, what if I start playing with that and seeing how can I do better to eventually, you know, see, maybe I get to 5, you know, I know it exists, you know, it's neat.
Ryan Estrada did 158 Photoshop files in 30 minutes. I just looked it up on Twitter. Ryan Estrada on Twitter. I'll put it in the show notes.
You're reminding me of the power of automation. And I guess we did talk about an example where I did about, you know, 300 illustrations in, you know, roughly 30 minutes or however long it took that script to finish.
Exactly.
So anyway, but it's not the same. That's a far simpler thing. These were it's like parameterized card, playing card layout kind of things, fed with different images and stuff. Anyway,
yeah, not quite the same thing. No, for sure.
No.
But that was point one that I wanted to get at, was is like, make sure that you know who you're doing this for. I think that's the first way to get more out of what you're doing, because, you know. There's the little piece of lizard brain inside my head that reacts whenever somebody has a really successful Kickstarter or gets a news blurb about their successful model of approach. And I go, ooh, I should be doing that. I really should be doing that too, because that's a really great idea. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not making any money at this stuff yet. And then I got to stop and go, dude, stop it. Back off. Calm down. Focus on it from your point of view and find the thing that works for you. Yes, listen to what else is going on out there and see what ideas it gives you, but don't resist that initial urge to just jump in and do what somebody else did because that worked for them, right?
Oh, yeah. It's again, like, how do you bring that to your own experience? It's up to you. I mean, you don't have to just try to copy that as a step-by-step method that's somehow magically universal, which is the fallacy of that is, if it were universal, it probably would become like diffused or less useful as all of a sudden everyone started totally doing it. Yep. And here, the funny thing is that throws that back on its head. It's like saying, oh, someone did this already. Why should I do that? It's been done and whatever.
Yeah.
There's always that nuance of whatever that individual's approach to and the situation they've built up, their whole ecosystem and who they're trying to serve and talk to and whatever, that they've got their individual circumstance that they've built up and were able to be effective with. So it's neat to be able to witness that sometimes. I don't know if you had an extension to that, but I had extension to the, I totally agree. It's definitely not a binary thing as far as doing less is better and doing more is bad, because, for me, I actually love to throw myself in over my head on a regular basis.
That's how we started this one. Yeah.
And I still love to do that, but I don't want to be robotic in that way. Like, I have to believe your D&D character, the scared, super powerful dude.
Yeah.
Right. Like that, there would have to be some context where that person wouldn't be scared. Like there's a thing that is a part of their life or experience or a need, a circumstance that how they are normally, unless that person really is being played as a robot and is unable to adapt or has some other emotional challenge, right?
You know what what set him at ease was close physical contact with others. So hugging, cuddling.
Funny. So
yeah.
Gosh, I don't even know if it's okay to say this, but like it's kind of like Master Blaster in Mad Max then, right? So if he were cuddled by someone riding his back all the time,
yeah,
maybe he'd just be unstoppable.
Yeah, yeah, it was like that. Yeah, that's really what it was. That set him at ease and made him, you know, feel like everything's okay. In a lot of ways, very, very different from me, who's always had issues with people getting too close.
But pointing out the adaptability. Well, yeah. There you go. It's fun to try a character that's different than you, right? And for me, I know like certain strategies I like a lot, or situations I like to put myself in, and approaches I like to do to manage it. But I also don't want to be a robot about it. So I've been taking a different tact lately when it comes to being in a bit over my head and adapting. And instead of just saying, okay, yep, I'm going to do less sleep and redefine all the tasks and do all these things. I'm taking a different approach.
What inspired this different approach? When did you know it was time to take a different approach rather than just keep on? Because, you know, it's like when we talk about just diving in and chipping away, like we started with, I also think of the negative inflection of that, which is Boxer from Animal Farm, the big horse who whenever somebody'd say, oh, but something's wrong on the farm. Well, I guess I'll just work harder, you know, and that was his answer to everything, was just to work harder until they took him to the glue factory. You know, so there's the example of the guy who doesn't question what's going on around him, just keeps pushing and pushing and pushing, you know. Was it Sisyphus who had the big rock up the hill?
Yep. What? So maybe it was sort of a, I don't know, resonance with a good myth that caused me to question it, because let's see, I would say one of the things that helps me is trying to find perspective when I feel a big change. And I went from a certain workload that was working well for me before, but then I switched it to like the more traditional full-time workload. And that changed my availability for all my other projects to an extreme. And I think they're, I don't know what to call it, maybe natural forces in a way. Like, okay, I want to do these things and I need to do those things. And how do I work that out? And some of it really wasn't a rational choice. It was just backing away a little bit it was reflex.
Okay. So like you knew like reflexively when you know, like, okay, I got to calm down.
Yeah, maybe it's that. Yeah.
It's like that. It's like when you feel your temper rising a little bit, and you're like, nope, if it goes any further, a lamp's going to get knocked over, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. You can feel it when it's about to get there, right? At least like most rational adults can feel that switch flicking. Like in another second, if I don't do something about this right now, furniture is going to get broken, you know, that kind of feeling. And so you go, all right, I'm going to calm down. You either count to 10, you go for a walk, whatever, run your fingers through your hair, whatever you got to do. But like, there's a reflex that happens, and you were talking about you detecting that with your workload, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, now I'm still puzzling things out as far as my different projects, but I'm also not paralyzed by it either, because I have picked the one that I want to really, well, the couple that I am sticking with. And I know it's going to ebb and flow too, where I will end up getting more practiced at my new load. And then much like you described your approach to tackling projects in the earlier 2000s, you know, you get used to your workload and yeah,
you find a rhythm, but that has to come with time. I want to get at this word paralysis that you talked about just a second ago. You threw out the word paralysis. When you say paralysis, what is can you put words to what that emotion is? Because you're not talking about like literal, of course. You're talking about like a mental paralysis. Like what is that emotional state like?
It is it's a bit like that pause in the podcast. your question had such high intensity, I needed to escape. I think paralysis, it's sort of, it's interesting. Yeah. Cause I did use that word on purpose and I'm trying to think of how I wove it in, but I think if it's a reaction, it's sort of, like a forced distance, like a reflex pulling you away from a heat source, right? Oops, that pan is really hot. Boom. Your hand is like instantly a couple feet away from the pan.
Yeah.
paralysis. I suppose it, when it's out of reflex, what does it feel like? Because I'm also thinking about what it serves at the same time while I'm thinking about what it feels like.
Yeah, I'm just asking you to be a poet for a moment and describe that sensation, right?
Let's see.
Because this is
different for me at different times. Like there's sometimes like paralysis is like an ultimate shock of just fear, being overwhelmed, being stunned and frozen into in by some amount of overwhelming input. Becoming frozen.
Yeah. Too much. I don't know where to start. This is a big mess.
Yeah. And so instead of like freaking out and joining the bubbling boil of everything else going on around, it's just becoming totally still. And sometimes that is more calm than other times.
Yeah.
You know, so
at least if you're not moving, then nothing's happening. You have time to digest the situation if you're not moving. You know, you talked earlier about that strange attractor. You know, if you stop moving, you won't be the strange attractor. You won't make any kind of weird patterns emerge out of this. Let me just drink this in for a second. Let me try to buy myself some time and stall the universe while I try to cope with this situation, right?
Yeah. And I think that's sometimes the reaction. Other times, I think it's more of a deliberate rhythm pause, where it's more of an active pause. I guess that maybe there's a reactive paralysis, and then the active would be more of a rest or a pause.
Yeah, that's a very Taoist thing to intentionally create a pause, no matter what anybody else thinks of the situation, right? Because it's about just being there, and it's also about just assessing the situation, you know, rather than just simply reacting to everything around you. Let's make a mindful reaction. And a mindful reaction in Taoism often comes out of an empty mind, which seems weird, but read the Tao Te Ching, read Zhuangzi, And, you know, it'll make sense eventually. You know, what's interesting is that paralysis is usually the moment when I know that adaptation is imminent, or it better be, or I'm going to crack up. And that paralysis is usually followed by a almost a crippling sadness. Mm. Not to get too intense about this, but, you know, it's like usually that moment of, oh, dear, this is too much. What am I going to do? Is immediately followed by, I can't do it. Right. And then that moment when I say, and this is like maybe sometimes the span of a second, sometimes the span of a minute, sometimes it's an afternoon, but it's usually followed by like a really deep sadness that it can't be done, even though intellectually I know it can be done. You know, like my frontal lobe is saying, don't worry, you can do this. But then that stupid lizard brain is going, no, you can't. Oh, no. This is the moment where you failed. And I think it's partially, and this is where we get at maybe something that's more reactionary, is it's as a defense mechanism. I've developed a sense of, let's get out of that as quick as we can, because that's not a happy place to be. That's not a good place to exist in that mental state. And whatever I can do, and so I'll do, you know, break out the emergent task planner, chip away. Getting lost in the work is the only thing that saves me. But getting more out of less, to manage that situation, adapting that situation by trying to maximize the work. You know, here's where I can get to like the stupid helpy tips. Can we call them that from now on? This is a stupid helpy tip. I like that. I like that because it properly couches it that this is not necessarily useful, but you can give it a try. No guarantees. Stupid helpy tip. I don't often get to coin things on the show. Just throw me a bone on this one.
You got it.
Is, you know, the way to, if it's an emotional thing, if it's something where I'm feeling rotten about being overwhelmed, and that creeping, nagging fear of, this is the time you failed, kid. This is the time where you don't win. And then I go, okay, well, I got to chip away at something. For God's sakes, jurors, do not chip away at the thing that's going to require any amount of creativity whatsoever, because you will fail and you're going to fall even further. Mm. You take on the chipping away thing that requires the least amount of mental energy, flatting a page, right? Cleaning up some inks digitally, like fixing some errors on a page, or doing some simple, you know, business management. Like, I'm going to go into my spreadsheet, I'm going to update my income spreadsheet. I'm going to do some file management, some whatever little thing. I'm going to clean up my office a little bit, whatever little thing to take some of the brunt off of that load that requires, like, you know, I don't know about you, but like when I'm stressed out, I'll do the dishes, you know, a dumb little thing like that, a manual task to put my brain someplace. It becomes meditative. It gets something done that needs to be done. So you have that emotional benefit. And then you're recharged so that you can go back and take on the bigger things again. That sounds dumb. It sounds like something out of the Oprah Winfrey show. But, you know, I find that that's what helps me when I'm in, when the paralysis is accompanied by a negative emotional state. Did I say words?
Another way to summarize what you said is, when you do find yourself in that fearful situation, take one more step toward becoming Oprah.
Yeah. And you'll find something under your chair that will delight you.
It was stupid helpy tips. Was that what it was?
Stupid helpy tip. Yeah. Let me jot that down in case that's t-shirt worthy.
I think it is. It's I don't know. Like, I would bet a lot of people do, that listen to the show get run into those situations where, what would you describe that? I bet how, I don't know. Have you ever read Getting Things Done?
What's it, David Allen?
David Allen's, yeah, Getting Things Done.
No, it's been years for me. Yeah.
It's been years, but, I think, he endorses that same idea, and he calls it, cranking widgets, I think.
Oh, there you go.
Where it's basically, technically you still function, right? You're able to sit there and fret about whatever thing you're not able to accomplish and that's freezing you or whatever the heck, but all of a sudden, you know, you're still breathing and able to move and all that stuff probably. So, well, you can still do stuff, and there's just other a different category of thing you're still ready to keep tackling.
Mm-hmm.
And
a lot of David Allen's philosophy revolves around this idea of getting stuff out of your brain,
mm-hmm.
right? Get it out of your brain now, and then just capture it someplace so that you can take it on later when you have the energy for it or when it's time to do it. But sitting yeah. around and fretting about it does no good, right? But capturing it and assigning it does. I think that's like a big part of his core philosophy, is it not?
Yeah, it is. I mean, so here's what I found useful. And I've actually gone through phases where, you know, I never was like a zealot about getting things done, but I tried it. And I also tried coming up with my own approaches like that. And it's, but much like how I really enjoy like facing a good art challenge and then being in over my head, I know like there's more than one kind of solution out there, and I want to expose myself to more approaches and whatnot. So I end up eventually shedding it, whatever I'm currently choosing to utilize.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, gaining some other perspective, sometimes forgetting or losing, but I just, you know, just move on and some of the things stick or whatnot. But with the, of late, so when I was facing that, after a few weeks into switching, you know, the amount of hours I was putting into my projects and whatnot, and I felt that kind of, that change is coming. Like there's the list of projects I had going on, and there's like big projects and things that I've talked about plenty publicly. Like I don't have plans to end them. Like I even did some podcasts recently about this whole juggling thing and stuff. And I will be doing that, but I think it'll be more over a longer period of time juggling. Yeah. And it's going to be a different thing. And I'm still feeling that out. And what I did actually was I did a combination of doing less and then also, doing one or two marathon sessions against what I wanted to work on, and just seeing what happened naturally.
Okay.
And I still used my to-do lists, but it's like I didn't like follow them in such a dedicated step-by-step fashion where like I knew a lot of crap wasn't going to get done.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to see almost like, I don't know, like maybe if I was going to, you know, build a house in a valley, find out where it would be easier for me to build instead of finding exactly the one spot and being overly attached to that and having him one heck of a time trying to make it work.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit of stepping back and cranking widgets, but also like the widgets were still, it was a creative project. I mean, it was working on that game development class and figuring out some things about that, but anyway, I don't even know if there's anything in there. I'm just kind of sharing. I'm just sharing what I did.
Well, I like this idea of not being a slave to a task manager or to-do list as well. I think that's an important one because that one can easily trip you up and make you feel, you know, it's the old joke, oh, the sun's shining today, oh, but it's going to rain tomorrow. That mentality of, oh, well, I got this wonderful to-do list, like, I even went so far as to take my emergent task planners and bind them. I'm showing Rob, you guys can't see it in the audio, but in the video, and I put like a special cover on it, and I've got like all these like fancy binder clips with like these task order up things that David Say designed. So like I got all into this DTP thing. But you know what? When I was really cranking hard some days, didn't track nothing that day. You know, because I forgot to. I didn't track every day because I marked the date the night before. Oh, tomorrow, May 14th, 2012, you're going to, you know, here's the task that you're going to track. I didn't track them because I was working too hard and I got lost in it, you know, because being a slave to like organizational tools are great. But if you're a slave to them, then that is another opportunity for you to feel terrible about not adhering to it.
And it's possible to not adapt when you would need to.
Yep.
Where all of a sudden this thing that was totally serving you has you stuck. So it's a good time to ignore it.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've made my case many times on these shows that I'm not an anarchist, but I'm not a fan of rules. Like, I don't, you know, I'm not a fan of a strict adherence to rules. The fastest way to incite my anger is to be bureaucratic, right? Well, that's just the way to do things, sir. I'm not ready to engage with you like a human being, right? All that stuff. We've talked about this a million times.
You put that form in the wrong box. That form goes 12 steps this way and that box to the right, not the one on the left.
And you know what? We all know that that's funny. We all know that is ridiculous. Yet humans still act like that sometimes, which blows my mind. But anyway, you know, but at the same time, I don't like to just do pure improvisation. I think that there are parameters that you have to set, and then but those parameters are they can move, right? It's like a slide rule. It can go zip, zip, back and forth, and it's A-okay. But yeah, you know, it's like these organizational tools, they're only there for when I need them, and something you know when you need them and when you don't, right? Or at least you get a sense of it over a period of time. I don't know. I'm not inside anybody sometimes, else's head.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I know people who have stuck with those kinds of things for years, and they're totally happy about that, and it's all good. It's all good for them. But yeah, for me, I know I will feel trapped, even though, yeah, I'm typically pretty disciplined about it. But there are times when, yeah, I hit the paralysis, or I hit I'm all about to get to that paralyzed moment, and I'd pause instead and take a breath and then go feral. No, I'm kidding. No, then I just let go and try to find what will, it's that gut thing where I'm like, okay, what's natural right now, and seeing where that leads me.
Another one that I think helps when you're cranking widgets or chipping away at something is I heard about this while listening to This Week in Google podcast, one of the Twitch shows. Gina Trapani of, what's her web address? Smartaware.org, is that right? That's what I wanted to say.
That sounds right.
She recommended, as one of the software picks of the week a couple weeks back, this thing called, and let me look it up because I'm getting emails from them now. Oh, where are you? Oh, for crying out loud, where is it? TimeHop. Have you heard about this?
No.
Okay, so TimeHop is the service that you can plug in your Twitter feed and Facebook feed into, even in your Instagram feed, and it scours your feeds for a year ago today, and it sends you an email. It composes a little email composed of all your social media posts from that day 1 year ago. Now, this can be both good and bad, because a story that I told a year ago, actually, I got this email 3 days ago. I went and did a talk. This was during my artist in residency in Chelsea. Remember, they made me artist in residence there last year, which meant I did a lot of public events for them and led a lot of classes. Super fun. But there was this big event where I was doing a sort of like a, I don't know, keynote talk kind of dealy for this big important breakfast with like the mayor was there and all of these important people from the local area were there. And it was for them to showcase Chelsea's artist in residence, to say, like, look at the awesome guy we've got for this program. And I step up to the podium. Yeah, I'll tell the story first. I step up to the podium and I say, I'd like to thank the Ann Arbor District Library.
Dope.
500 people in the room. Boo, boo. They booed me. They honestly got booed me. And I rolled with it, and I was like, yeah, I know, boo, yeah, I hate Ann Arbor too, yeah. And so I quickly, you know, I just rolled with it, and I tried to get him on my side, and I think after 10 minutes of me joking around and being the kind of guy I am, I had him on my side again. They were all interested, and they're participating. I'm asking them questions. They're responding. It's the room's dynamic. They're laughing again. And then I'm like, whew, I got through that one okay. And then at the end of the whole banquet, lunch and breakfast dealy, all these people come up to talk to me. Oh, that was a great presentation. Too bad about what you said at the top, though, about Ann Arbor. Another person comes up. Oh, I loved your presentation. You're such a great speaker. Too bad about that thing you said at the top about Ann Arbor. 75 people later, I'm like, all right, I got it. I did a big blunder, right? Felt terrible at the time. But and I remember, you know, or I don't remember this, but I get the email from, what was that called again? TimeHop. And it says, yeah. It shows the Instagram photo of the banquet room that I was in. I tweeted that morning, like, getting ready to do a big speech. Hope I don't blow it. And then 2 hours later, it shows on the timeline. 2 hours later, it's like, okay, you know, I did a bad thing today and I screwed up and this and that. So it's not always good to be reminded of your past. Although it's good for a laugh now. It's a year later. I don't care. But I'm also getting posts showing stuff that I was working on a year ago that I've gotten past long behind me. Finish that thing. And it reminded me that it's a good idea every once in a while to remind yourself of what you have done, right? Not to pat yourself on the back eternally about past accomplishments. Anybody who has ever heard me talk, yes, I've talked about my graphic novel an awful lot over the last couple of years. I've worked on other things since then. I should stop talking about the graphic novel maybe. But I think it's a good reminder to us to when we're cranking, when we're feeling that whole, like, oh, I'm not getting as much done as I want to. Well, look at what you have done. And you're building something there. And I think it's okay to give yourself a little bit of a fist bump or do the double-handed shake over the shoulders every once in a while when you've gotten something done, because that's something that wasn't done before. And it wasn't done until you did it. So, God, that sounds like, okay, so we have, what was the first thing?
Stupid helpy tip.
Stupid helpy tip. This is stupid self-helpy tip. So, writing that down too. So, stupid self-helpy tip. But I mean, and it sounds like it totally sounds like that kind of self-help crap.
We wander on that the dangerous line between self-help and art journal and teaching art techniques and whatever. I mean, all the time with the podcast. So on the design series, I mean, like, talk about a soft topic there. You know, so if you. Oh, gosh, I mean, I guess that was a little while back, but maybe 10 episodes or so. We did a 3-episode design series.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and
who am I? How'd I get here?
I've got piles of follow-up to that, too, that I want to revisit at some point. There's
Oh, gosh, you know, this is where we're going. Oh, sorry, go ahead. Yeah. Finish your thought, and then I'll share mine.
So, well, I mean, that topic is, there is a discipline around communication, and we can observe aspects of it and talk about qualities of design and related, I don't know, useful ways of thinking and talking about it or whatever, and examples of it in the world and dissect them and all that. But even with all that and trying to be disciplined with it, it's a squishy topic, and it's not something that it isn't, surgery or something, right? Where you need a deep, huge connection of many different scientific approaches and disciplines with many, many, many tested ideas related to the things that help people breathe while the procedure is happening and help people know exactly where to cut and what to do and what's order and all that while the procedure. There's some things that are really, really incredibly deep like that. But then if you probably not too far away from that experience, are a lot softer ones where all of a sudden the doctor is talking about their best practices and how they present them and their bedside manner and how do they teach the next generation of doctors and all these things where all of a sudden there's a mix of those disciplines going on. And anyway, sharing that kind of stuff. We can call it the squishy zone.
Squishy zone. So yeah. Next episode is the one where we stop making disclaimers for what we're saying.
Okay. What do we like? Do we have a jar we put something into?
We do. We need a disclaimer jar where we put in 50 cents every time we make a disclaimer. You know, okay. I totally know why I do this, because it's exposure to the internet where every day I come across somebody who posts some stupid thing like, "Dear lady on the bus who wore those shoes, stop it, signed all of us." And then I want to say, I didn't sign that. I was over here. And I wouldn't sign that because I don't know why he has a problem with that person's shoes. But it's like there's the knee-jerk reaction to everything is to instantly apologize for being sincere or for not. Anyway, you know, it's that whole high school crap that pervades the internet that is so.
Oh,
weird.
Sure. And I guess I went off on a way long tangent just for that, because in we could have just, you know, tied it off with your quick comment there, but it's there's squishy things are worth exploring.
And, yes, they are.
Yeah.
And you know what? here's my pledge, everybody. I will quit drinking. I'm going to have my 1 week chip next week to show that I'm not going to make disclaimers for the stuff anymore. I'm just going to say it. If you don't like it, you don't have to listen. But, you know, adapting, dealing with too much, dealing with a change in your availability. I think we touched on a few things there.
Mm-hmm.
I think we did some, I did my stupid helpy tip, and, you know, we talked about a few anecdotes about dealing with the emotional state and everything. But I think the big idea is that if you have a creative pursuit of any kind, whether it is your full-time job or your part-time thing, and especially if it's your part-time thing, then adaptation is the name of the game. You aren't guaranteed, even people who do this for a living aren't guaranteed any kind of regular workflow. You know, it's like I know agented writers who have been told by their agent, sit tight, wait till this happens, and then you can go to work, right? And then it's like a mad dash to work until next waiting. So, you know, that's part of the gig. And, you know, I don't have any advice for that except that, you know, it's tough. And the trick for me is just to keep playing emotional tricks on myself so as not to succumb to that horrible, self-pity and self-loathing that we creative types are so want to inflict upon ourselves.
I think it's, I think that's where I think it's fun to test yourself with the challenges, you know, pick an art challenge, go beyond your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you know what you're trading off. Right. I mean, it's like, I know what it's like to do the 30 characters in 30 days for my definition of it. And, what that does as far as, you know, time with my wife and, you know, time with a variety of other things that, for example, so that now I know, you know, I know what it's like to keep a comic going or to work on, you know, whatever. I mean, so once in a while we make comments on the show, and I think they're fun and funny and stuff about like, oh, I work on all these different things. And by we, I mean you.
What?
they're like, oh, Rob, who does this and who does that? And this, the secret behind it all is like, I do it, it's like a serial thing. It's not all going on at once. And once in a while, and so I have a perspective of, well, boy, I really had a throughput and I did achieve these things. I will look back and yeah, maybe I'm trying to, you know, re-celebrate some old achievement once in a while, but a lot of it is taking on the next thing. I just have this comfort, this familiarity of like, well, here's a new situation to adapt to and I don't know exactly what I'm going to do with it. I'm going to make that up and
yeah,
keep moving.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to say this without apology. You know, it's like when I was going through the deadline and I was feeling those bouts of, you know, I'm going to start talking like I'm some kind of like manic depressive. I'm not. But you know, you get sad sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this whole thing for you know, that I was puzzling out with my projects. It's frustrating.
You get frustrated.
Yeah, it's difficult.
And then suddenly, like, the inner voice changes to like, you know, gym teacher, like the gym teacher from Freaks and Geeks. I forget what his name was in that, but Biff from Back to the Future, starts yelling at me. And is like, dude, you are making a comic. You're getting paid to make this comic. This comic is going to be given to your target audience. You're making it specifically for them, and you get to deliver it to them at a big assembly where there's going to be 500 kids who you get to hand deliver the comic to. Shut up. You don't get to feel sad. You are not allowed to feel sad in this situation. If you don't like it, go get a job at Arby's or whatever, but shut up. You know, there's also that, too. You know, it's like, yeah, even if you're not making a living at this stuff, I don't make a lot of money. And I don't know if that's like a good or a bad thing to admit, but I don't make a lot of money at this stuff, but I make some. But the fact that you're able to do it at all, you know, well, that itself is kind of like a, you know.
There's two comments. So it's almost like you get to write your own story about how you're tackling this. And I mean, I don't know. That's very self-helpy territory, but
Yeah.
You get to, yeah, well, you get to. And
you,
then
you get to be the tortured artist who slaves away at the thing and is not appreciated, or you get to be the person that says, this is a good time. And both are valid approaches to the thing, whatever, yeah, is, whatever kind of person you are, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And then, you know, you saying you're not successful, which is like, I'm sitting here looking at you and you're calling me from Skype from somewhere near the equator, perhaps Hawaii. I see like, you know, yeah, fantastic golf course behind you. And
yeah, of course. You know. Hold on, Alec Baldwin. I'll be there in a minute. Yeah.
So, but yeah. I guess there's always new heights to reach, isn't there?
There always is. Yeah. There's always.
Which, I mean, I think I win as far as the most lame statement right there, by the way. So,
but yeah. It's weird. I don't know what else there's to say about it, except it's weird. It's a weird balance of we are creative creatures, and creative creatures tend to have sort of their emotions on the surface or close to the surface. And it's easy to oscillate between those two poles. And when you're in a state of adaptation or a place where it's about time to adapt to a situation, yeah, it can get pretty stressful sometimes. And panic, or rather paralysis, isn't necessarily a bad thing. It could be a moment of taking a pause, a breath, and analyzing the situation. And then also, you know, meditative stuff like doing manual labor, grinding the gears, or chipping at the thing. See? Mm. There was content in there, Rob.
There was. Layered in there.
Just needed Jerry's final thought at the end of it.
Jerry Drazin.
Jerry Drazin's final thought. Oh, God. I'm so tired. All right. But, final thought. Also, you know what? When you're doing Don't Tip the Waiter, sometimes things need to fall off, and that's okay. Sometimes you cancel appointments. Sometimes, yeah. So, I think we talked about that last time. I seem to remember us talking about Don't Tip the Waiter. Yeah.
We did. Yep. I don't remember the example, but I remember thinking that they really have some bleak games that they're modeling, or they're, you know what, they were channeling some frustration from their day jobs when they were designing those things.
It could be,
you know.
I've got an idea for a game. It's called My Life, by Parker Brothers.
Exactly, My Life's Tough. I remember. There's a lot of interesting challenge years ago with this came up recently with a client situation because of which I wouldn't go into detail, but it reminded me of my time in the janitorial industry of how so playing a game. I know this is a silly extra tangent to throw at the end of the podcast, but you know what? When you're really sleepy. And it's you're working third shift and you're running a machine that has a spinning pad on it powered by propane that sounds like a low flying airplane, yet has this gentle drone to it where eventually it sounds so peaceful. Yet it has this pad that's going around at like, I don't know, like 1,000 RPMs, right?
It'd take melting your skin off.
Exactly. That could melt the floor. That's melting the floor in front of you and you're walking behind it. That is a thing to make sure that you don't hurt anyone. You don't want to hit something, and it kicks up this dust, this crazy tornado of wind all around you. Yeah. And there's all this delicate crap on the shelves, and there's this game in there somewhere, Parker Brothers. That's what I'm trying to say. There's a game in there. Where is it? Where's my game? Waiter's got one.
Anyway. That's how you know you've made it into mainstream society, is when Parker Brothers makes a game about your career.
Oh, and so don't push the comic artist.
Don't push the comic artist.
I'm sorry. All right.
Okay. Well, I think there was some stuff in there, Rob. I apologize for any words that didn't amount to a sentence.
Hell no. No apologies.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay, next time for sure.
Good ideas, bad ideas, either way, we ride.
Yeah, we fake our way through it so that we come full circle. All right. Well, if you enjoyed this tomfoolery and fakery and cheap Jack flummery, you know what you could do to help out the show is go to iTunes and say, hey, I'm going to give these guys a star review. They kept me company today. They made me laugh. They made me smile. Whichever it was. We're not asking for any money. All you got to do is give a star review. That helps other people find this stuff. You can't be the only one who likes it, right? And maybe if other people find it, then, you know, you'll find that you're part of a community eventually. So you benefit. That was kind of a stretched promise there, but
we're just saying, like, so if you're hanging out, you're kind of bored, invite your friends over.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, it'll be fun for everybody.
But yeah, that's the only thing that we're going to ask you guys to do. We'll have other calls to action later, but for right now, the really number one way you can help out the show is give us a star review on iTunes, and that's as simple as looking up Jersey Drozd or Rob Stenzinger on iTunes, and our shows will be listed there, and you can give us a little thumbs up. And it's not to boost our egos, but rather to help other people find this thing that you found useful. So there we go.
Yep. It's called meritocracy.
Meritocracy. Yes. Give us credit where credit is due. Any news, appearances, things, plugs?
Plugging away at that, at the game development class. Can't wait. I mean, it's still in progress. Still in progress. More to be announced soon, but not too soon.
Not too soon. It's about a month away from, about a month and a week away. A month away by the time this goes live. I'm going to be at the American Library Association annual conference in Anaheim, California, from June 21st through the 26th, somewhere in the neighborhood. So I know we have listeners in California, in Southern California, and if you guys want to get together, let me know. I'm Jersey on Twitter. You can email us at leanintoart@gmail.com or, ping us on Google Plus or Twitter. We haven't figured out where the heck we want to land with the social networking for Lean Into Art yet, but either of those places will get our attention. But yeah, it'd be cool to hang out with some California cartoonists while I'm out there. Come say hi to me in the Artist Alley at the American Library Association Conference. And then July 6th, 7th, and 8th, Rob is going to be in Ann Arbor for Kids Read Comics.
I suppose, yeah. I guess it's not too soon to share that.
No, it's not. It's coming up pretty fast.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to take live workshops with Rob Stenzinger, and it looks like I'm going to be doing some programming as well this year, which is
sweet.
Yeah.
I always thought it was like, you know, it's like some kind of show where you're some kind of like music festival put on by Elvis, but Elvis doesn't show up, you know?
Is that how it is?
Yeah.
That's intensely flattering. In past years, as the programming guy, director, head of programming, the guy who helps develop all the programming for the show, organizes it. I'm too busy to put on my own workshops. I'm too busy making sure everybody else's workshops are going well. But this year I've got help. So it looks like one of the things that Eli was kind of leaning on me about was doing a live Comics Are Great recording with a live studio audience at Kids Read Comics.
Super cool.
That'd be fun. And then also, you know, it's just possible that I might be able to do one of my professional development workshops, which you've attended before, back at the Up Fair. So,
yeah. So it's the, what was it called?
How to lead a comics workshop.
Yep.
Yeah, a few more words. Yep. But yeah, I might be able to do that one this year. I'm working on the programming list right now. So we'll see what I can fit in there. But yeah, it'll be fun to actually participate in my event this year.
Awesome.
Either way, it's just super fun just to have so many positive, plugged-in cartoonists in one town. I mean, you were there last year. There's a really good vibe about this event.
Absolutely.
And I make no apologies for saying that because we work hard to attract people who help generate that vibe, you know? So.
Yeah, if you're anywhere near the area, it's well worth your time to make the jaunt out to Ann Arbor. I'm making the jaunt and I'm coming from Minneapolis. So
yeah, see, he's coming. You should too. We're working hard to develop programming that will appeal to the working cartoonist as well as kids. So don't let the name fool you. It's Kids Read Comics, but that's just so that we can differentiate to say kids are welcome here, unlike some traditional comic conventions where Bubarella is there to sell her latest book. You know, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing
adults.
Wrong with Bubarella, everybody.
No, nothing wrong with it. It's just just serving a different market, different focus. So I'd be happy to put on workshops at the Bubarella convention or two or whatever. So that's fine.
Oh man,
it might be tame compared to the next guy's workshop, but hey,
yeah. But anyway, yeah, it's a good time. You know, a lot of people said nice things about last year. So if you're on the fence about coming, you should come anyway. And think about doing it soon because hotels are on the short end in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. We don't have many hotels in this town, so hotel rooms are going to get expensive fast, and you might have to wind up staying like 20 minutes out of town in order to be able to attend the event, which isn't the end of the world, but, you know, it's not as convenient as being within walking distance of the event. So,
okay. True, true. Got to get on that.
Get on it. All right, well, I got to get out of here. Thank you, Rob, for this good discussion.
My pleasure, Jersey. Thank you. No apologies.
No apologies.
Unbridled thanks. You don't like it? Thanks anyway.
That's awesome. I'm writing that down too. You don't like it? Thanks anyway. That's such a polite way to give somebody the finger. I love it. All right. So thanks everybody for downloading and listening. Until next time, I have been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay. Bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart. And you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.